Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
And we launch with a mighty shout out to the people who subscribe and support this program, including Anna H. Gordonier, Joey Hunter, Michael Gill, and Faith Peoples. We heard from Faith this week. Thank you. You can join that crowd funding the Peter B. Collins Show. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Under my mugshot on the upper left corner of the homepage are the links to follow if you'd like to set up your very own subscription, starting at just $5 a month. Kevin Gostola returns to our program today. He's been live blogging extensive coverage of the court-martial proceedings against Private First Class Bradley Manning.
This ain't no technological breakdown. Oh no, this is the road.
And Kevin joins us once again to recap the proceedings at Fort Meade, Maryland. And there have been some surprises, Kevin. First and foremost, I was surprised that the defense only put on about half of the estimated number of witnesses that were predicted. And that, after about three and a half days, the defense has rested.
It really was almost less than 3 days, but about 3 days we heard testimony from nine live witnesses who were present in court. And then there was one witness who had testimony entered into the record that had been agreed upon between the prosecution and defense. That was a stipulation. And it did go much faster than we all expected.
And the entire proceedings, I mean, the prosecution presentation was shorter than expected. And heck, you've staked out a place in Washington, D.C. for the whole summer, as you expected this to run well into August, didn't you?
Well, I mean, I haven't come under any personal financial issue having to expend any money that I'm not going to get back because the trial is shortened, if that's what you're asking. But there are many people who have expected to be involved in covering this trial until the end of August, as the military had advertised. And increasingly, it's looking that unless the judge takes 3 or 4 weeks to decide the conviction, unless the sentencing phase takes 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to be done with the prosecution of Bradley Manning and his trial sometime by the first couple weeks of August.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into some of the recaps of recent events, just in the big picture, it struck me, and it was played out this way in my local newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle. The defense in the Manning case rested on the same day as the defense in the George Zimmerman case, related to the Trayvon Martin killing in Florida. And it is amazing to me how much coverage that local murder case gets. And I recognize that it's been blown up into a national story and that the stand your ground issues and that the racial tinge of it makes it somewhat newsworthy. But I made the point in my daily podcast yesterday that 10 years from now, George Zimmerman will be the answer to a Jeopardy question. And I believe that the work of Bradley Manning is something that will have a long-term impact, at least I hope it will, on American governance and the expansive national security state. How does it feel for you when the corporate media kind of, you know, dips in and out of the Manning case, and the coverage is extremely spotty all week long. I couldn't find anything on the programs that I watch on MSNBC.
It's a sad state of the media that even as we have this saga playing out with NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, that they wouldn't also find that if there is a lot of interest in his case, there might also be a lot of interest in Bradley Manning's case, and that people might find it to be significant that a lot of the issues in the trial are of interest to the public, that the public should be paying attention to what is the biggest leak case in the history of the United States, if not the world. And so what has been apparent to me as a reporter and seeing people come and go is that you have individuals for like the New York Times or the Washington Post that only want to be there when they know that news is going to break, and they'll come just on the days where they feel obligated to be there. Mm-hmm. For example, it's the start of the trial. It's the start of the defense's case. The defense is resting. Or this witness is going to testify, and he's a big name, and we're going to blow it up in the headlines, but after we won't be there the next day. And what happens is they don't have that understanding of what they're watching. They have to ask other reporters what is happening in this trial so that they can do their own news reports. And it's evident to me that you have to be there every single day because it all accumulates. You have to see it building up toward its conclusion. And if you weren't tracking the pretrial process and you just joined in for the trial, you don't understand why certain things are happening in this case, or you don't fully understand how Manning's statement on February 28th made it pretty likely that you weren't going to see Bradley Manning testifying in the trial. Mm-hmm. He would not need to testify in the trial. It would be bad, actually, for him if he testified in the trial. And many, many people from the press were contacting the Bradley Manning Support Network person asking, when is Bradley Manning going to testify? When is Bradley Manning going to testify? Only focused on this very small little aspect of what they were hoping would be a sensational episode in the trial that they could present to the public. But they really need to get into these issues. And I think we will get into this in the interview, just how on Wednesday it became clear how this trial is at the center of a struggle over journalism and freedom of the press. You could really tell that through testimony from Professor Yochai Bankler of Harvard University as he was testifying about WikiLeaks. But I don't think that the press in the United States was willing to engage in that discussion. It implicates them. It forces them to look at themselves. So we haven't seen in the coverage this sort of examination of how the trial would impact certain freedoms here in the United States.
Well, and Kevin, I feel it's worth adding that these same media outlets had no hesitation to exploit the WikiLeaks revelations at the time that they surfaced, and to cherry-pick the ones that would catch the most eyeballs, sell the most newspapers. And, you know, I know how this game works, and I'm not trying to be overly idealistic, but I do think that the news outlets that benefited from the risk-taking that Bradley Manning engaged in, you know, owe him, I think, honest coverage and detailed coverage of this important court-martial proceeding.
I think that those are really good points to make. And I also would add, because I think people might look to me as I make a lot of criticism about other media outlets, I share it with others because I really do spend a substantial amount of time looking at the way they interpret these leaks, the way they cover whistleblowers. I think it's important because I believe that in some ways it influences the perception of these cases and the people who are involved or who are being prosecuted. I just think that it's not really idealism. It's wondering why these media organizations have abandoned their self-interest so much that they're so willing to be servile to the government and not look out for their own skin. I have to think that after the Associated Press realized that their records were seized by the Justice Department, and after the New York Times knows its reporter David Sanger is being investigated for publishing stories on Stuxnet related to cyber warfare against Iran, and you've got all these other instances like Fox News's reporter James Rosen being accused of aiding and abetting and being a co-conspirator in violation of the Espionage Act because he tried to work a source in the State Department named Stephen Kim, who's now facing prosecution and indicted under the Espionage Act, that these media organizations would see that they should pay attention to these issues, not just because maybe the public should know about them, but also because as a organization, it's very critical for them to investigate and explore what the government is doing because they should know what kind of risk they face. And if they would like to live on and continue to do their work as a press organization and not, you know, go the way of a hundred of newspapers as those have perished because of new technology, then they should probably start to get more aggressive in their pursuit of information about how the government is monitoring, tracking, investigating, and going after U.S. media outlets.
Well, and it's very interesting. I've recently been talking with Russell Tice, the original NSA whistleblower who was a major source for Risen and Lichtblau at the New York Times. And Russ told me that he didn't get along with Eric Lichtblau that well. But he described him as unwilling to listen to the hints that Russ gave that those reporters were being surveilled by the NSA at that very time. And he described Lichtblau as kind of just uninterested or arrogant to the point where he believed that it couldn't be true that the NSA was wiretapping him. And so I do think that there is a certain attitude among some star reporters for the major outlets that they are above this. And I know that James Risen no longer believes that because it's very clear through the efforts to intimidate him into testifying that he was surveilled in a very comprehensive way.
In fact, when I was waiting to go into the trial, an anecdote was that New York Times reporter was joking that within the Times they've been talking about sending James Risen to cover the Bradley Manning trial at Fort Meade because he's the NSA's public enemy number one, or was until Snowden went public since he had put out all that information on the agency for the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, what you say is incredibly true, and I don't think that a lot of reporters do what they should do to practice good operational security so that they can interact with their sources without putting them at risk. I'm very careful to not talk or interact with somebody if they're going to provide me information over my general email and everything, and I've been hesitant to I want to make sure that anybody who is trying to communicate with me understands that the general way that I'm communicating is compromised, that they shouldn't reach out without making arrangements before or giving me a lot of time to prepare what I'm doing. And that's clear with Bradley Manning. To swing it back to the case of Bradley Manning,
mm-hmm.
he obviously ended up in some ways, I think, ended up at WikiLeaks because he did not think he could be protected if he made disclosures to the New York Times or Washington Post. And there is that reality that they didn't respond when he tried to contact them, or that he on his own was having trouble establishing a connection. But the reluctance that he had to follow through and go to the Post's office, the Washington Post office, or actually continue to call the New York Times was just that. He didn't want to expose himself to the risk of being found out. And right now, one of the values of WikiLeaks, and I think continues to be a value, assuming they can still accept submissions in some form, is that they can provide anonymity to these people, and you don't know who they are. And that sort of process needs to be developed by other news organizations as just a way of ensuring that they can continue to report on national security stories, because it is clear, as we're seeing with all of the things being disclosed by Snowden that's being covered in The Guardian, that everything is compromised. And you know this very well from talking to Russ Tice and in doing your own podcast, that you can't assume that anything is secure anymore.
And Kevin, on that note, let me just say that since the Russ Tice interview, I've received contacts, mostly by email, from a number of individuals who are either potential whistleblowers or who have information that they'd like to pass along to me or to Tice. And just as a matter of the kind of security that you described, I'm very wary that these could be phony contacts. These could be government agents posing. And so if you have contacted me and you're not satisfied because I haven't responded, understand that I'm taking some caution to prevent getting ensnared myself. And I think that any reporter has to be realistic about that, given what we know and what we have long suspected. So, Kevin, let's now dive into the proceedings. We had the July 4th break and then resumed. And give us a quick scene setter as to how David Coombs took the floor. And I believe one of his first moves was to present the collateral damage video.
Yes, this video that WikiLeaks labeled the collateral murder video in its release of the Reuters journalists being killed in Baghdad in an Apache helicopter attack in 2007. Someone came and tried to rescue these wounded people. His van got shot up. His two children were wounded. He was killed. And then you have a soldier, Ethan McCord, who can be seen in the video rescuing the children, later being told by his commanding officer not to worry about what he had just seen and what had really bothered him that day and started him questioning his role in the Iraq War. And this video was played in its entirety to the courtroom. Significantly, the prosecutors objected on relevance to playing the video at all, any portion of the video. That was an absurd objection. And the judge did not think it had any merit. So the prosecutors adjusted and made another objection. We only want you to play this video if you're going to play all of it, because Coombs only wanted to show the first 20 minutes. The first 20 minutes is the part that shows what has been most popularized, seen widely, of the journalists actually being killed, of the rescue operation being played out by U.S. forces. And there's other stuff towards the end there. And in fact, I don't think there's nothing in the last minutes. As I was watching the last 5 minutes, there's a decision made to fire missiles onto a building. And you see an individual walking right by the building who gets hit and killed, and it isn't clear to me as I'm watching who that person happens to be. Mm-hmm. They just seem to be assuming that that person, because he's in that vicinity, is an enemy of the United States, so it's okay to fire upon him. And this whole video was shown. Then they went on through to the next witnesses and began to bring commanders forward to talk about Manning. And the first day, there were many different people who came and took the stand. There were about six witnesses. It was the most intense of the days this past week.
And Kevin, before you go any further, can I just ask one more question about the collateral murder video? How did David Coombs contextualize it? Because I do think that if it's presented properly, it is a strong piece of evidence about a moral outrage that motivated Bradley Manning to expose this to the American people. And I'm just curious, you know, to what extent Coombs did frame it and how you think the judge responded to it.
There's one handicap I have for answering that question, which is when we were watching the press as a whole, when we were watching, the feed went down. And so we did not get to hear Coombs introduce the video before it was played. So I do not know what he said. And later I don't think that there was anything malicious going on. The hardware at Fort Meade is always malfunctioning, and we can theorize why that is. And maybe you want to bring Russ Tyson to figure out why a military base near the National Security Agency is always having problems with their internet and everything that connects to the courtroom. But it's just been a reality of trying to cover this trial as a reporter. And so we lost connection. And then they played the whole video for us during our lunch break. So all reporters did get to have that experience of seeing the full 39-minute video played by the court. But what I understand is that there's a book called The Good Soldiers that was written by David Finkel. And the reason why Coombs really wanted to show the video was so that it could become more than clear to the judge that this video was not, and the word that you use in the government is closely held. Mm-hmm. So if something's closely held, it means that there are actions being taken to protect that information from being disclosed to the public. And if any of the information that Manning released was not closely held, it makes it very difficult to convict him of that release of the information or to seriously sentence him to a long period of time in prison, because that's just the reality here. And so going forward, he presented this video because he argued that it was not closely held. If you look at that book, The Good Soldiers, then you can see that there's a verbatim transcript of the collateral murder video, and he had been given access to it when people at Reuters were denied a copy of the video in their FOIA request.
And the critical detail here is that Manning reportedly read The Good Soldiers before he acted, right?
Yeah, he was aware that this existed. So that's also why it's, you know, the prosecutors can't raise any objection. Mm-hmm. According to Manning's statement, he knew that this was out there, and he was bothered by the way that Finkel characterized the attack as something that was all right. Nothing going on here, nothing to see. He accepted the whole U.S. government line that this is following the rules of engagement, that there's nothing wrong with the way that the soldiers are making comments as if they're playing a video game during the whole sequence.
And there was, we'll move on now, there was a similar testimony kind of minimizing the damage from Colonel Morris Davis. And I've spoken to Mo Davis. He was a prosecutor at Guantanamo, and out of principle, he resigned that post when he was told that there could be no acquittals at Gitmo. And why don't you recap his testimony? Because it appears that, as you and I had speculated in advance, he did cite Andy Worthington's book and other resources to show that the vast majority of the information leaked in the Guantanamo files was already available.
Yeah, so the first thing to know is that these Guantanamo files that were released by Bradley Manning are detainee assessment reports. For anyone who forgets that, in April 2011, WikiLeaks published well over 700 of these, not all of them, not every single one, and for reasons I don't know, but released these detainee assessment reports that were biographies, summaries of information about all of the prisoners at Guantanamo that the JTF Gitmo put together on the prisoners. And Davis, in his testimony, said that these assessments are wildly inaccurate. It did not appear that he had used these in any serious way during his work. He made no effort to declassify them because he did not find them to be valuable to getting any prisoners off anybody who was trying to get due process, they would not have been beneficial to them, even though he described how he tried to get information declassified for these people. And he also, he shared how the information in them would not have provided any strategic or tactical advantage to any enemies of the United States. So it's very important for him to take that stand, and he was qualified as an expert to testify on Gitmo detainee policy and the information that would have influenced their detention, which meant that his testimony had a lot more weight. It wasn't just that he was giving the testimony, but the judge was asked to consider him an expert who could talk about this evidence or give his opinion, and it would have to be considered seriously by the judge.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Gostola, there was also testimony from a warrant officer named Joshua Arisman, who had served with Manning at the forward operating base in Iraq. And let's pause a second here. Is there any way to quiet down the noise in the background there, Kevin?
I'm relocating for just a moment.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So I had asked you the question. So tell us about Arisman's testimony, please.
Yes. Can you re-ask? Sorry, I'm actually failing to remember his testimony. There's a lot we went over in the week. So just can you ask me again and see if I can refresh?
Yeah, but let me read you the entry here. Arisman, an intelligence analyst specialist who reviewed all intelligence products produced in the facility where Manning worked, and it's related to how lax the rules were there about files and CDRs and that.
Oh, yes. Oh, and I remember. So he, so he took the stand and he was talking about how essentially his testimony again went to this reality that Manning was able to look at a lot of this information on his computer and there would not have been restrictions. I believe that was the significance of Arisman's testimony and going in and describing how generally speaking, there wasn't much restriction to what Manning could do. And we've been hearing this throughout the whole trial, that anytime that Manning wanted to, he was authorized to read information that was on the secret government network.
Mm-hmm. And this is really important because the perception that was created is that Manning was this, really furtive guy who was breaking all kinds of rules to first view this information and then copy it onto CDs that he made look like Lady Gaga music CDs. But the testimony of Arisman seemed to indicate that things were extremely lax at this forward operating base in Iraq.
Yeah. The word that they've used is that there was trust in the facility and that everyone believed that nobody would do this. Nobody would provide information to an outside press organization or enemies, or would make disclosures and violate their non-disclosure agreement that they had signed when they were given their security clearance. And I think that one of the things to focus on here, and we've talked about this just a little bit, is that Manning's releases were going on for a period of a couple months, and nobody is really being held responsible for the fact that the security was violated, and people do have responsibilities. There are rules and there are expectations of these individuals. I'm not saying this because I don't like that Manning disclose the information. There's been a lot of value and benefit to being able to read and report on this information. But I'm saying that Manning is being scapegoated to some extent, and individuals who also failed in their responsibility are getting off and have not been held to the same standard that Bradley Manning is being held.
And Kevin, I'm looking at a post here from your live blogging of cross-examination of Erisman by prosecutor Ashton Fine. And you write, one critical bit of testimony came when Erisman was being asked by Fine about why the SIGACs, the war logs, were classified secret. Fine addressed how information that was open source was typically unclassified. Then he asked, can it be classified if there is analysis with it? And this is an important point because I believe I saw a factoid that there were 92 million documents in 2011 or 2012 that were classified by the government. And I know that when you talk to people who work in these organizations, they say that things are routinely overclassified, and things that aren't remotely secret, you know, like yesterday's New York Times, will be stamped classified. And so I'm wondering if you feel that there was strong evidence presented to this court about excessive classification, and that should in some ways, result in less guilt. I don't know the way to put this, but it is less damaging because the information was not that sensitive or, as you said, closely held to begin with.
This is an important thing to get into because what Erisman is really saying in his testimony brings a focus to something that former Pentagon Papers legal counsel happened to say and has said, which is when he was working, he realized that there were published articles from the New York Times that were being classified back. We're going back to the 1970s now.
Yeah, right.
Were being classified as even top secret in some cases by the government. They would read what was published. It would be statements from government officials, we'll say, for this example, on the Vietnam War, and that would be classified top secret, even though it had been available for the public, and it was not classified information that the government was producing.
And Kevin, this is not a new development. I'll take you back to 1945, when my dear mother, who is now 89 years old, was a clerk at what was the precursor of the CIA. It was called the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. And she was assigned to read the English language newspapers from the Middle East every day, clip them, and file them. And she mostly won't tell me what she did when she worked there because it was secret. But she did say that she routinely put secret stamps on things that had been published in the newspaper. So, this has been going on for a long time. But to know that more than 90 million documents in a given year were classified to some extent just shows that we have, problems on many fronts of this leak issue.
But that's the thing, which the quick point that should be made is what he's saying is when you add analysis to these news articles, then you are in a position to classify that. That analysis is classified.
Mm-hmm.
I can accept that. But I also want everyone to know that in looking at the SIGACs, most of these are just reports of an incident. And what he was saying in his testimony was that, as far as he knows, most of the database are reports without any analysis. That you add that later, you add that after the fact, you add that in some cases you don't add it at all. And that if you look at a lot of the incident reports that Manning released, that WikiLeaks published as the war logs from Iraq or Afghanistan, what you see is just a report. This person killed in action. An IED went off. We were here in this city in Iraq, and this is what happened. And then the person who drafted the report may have signed it, and perhaps his name is out there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of information. There's no interpretation on what this means. There's little in the way of additional intelligence information as to say, this is a part of a string of events. This is what happens on a regular basis. And people would not be able to read that act, that military incident report, and be able to get a full idea of what it means that person was just killed in action.
And Kevin, let me use an extreme example here. I think that most people would agree that the codes used to launch a nuclear assault by the United States are classified as top secret. And most people would consider that a legitimate classification. And then if you look at 92 million documents in 1 year that are considered classified to some extent, we have to have some sort of a hierarchy here of what is truly a national secret and what is something that is embarrassing or maybe once, you know, people want to keep it confidential, but it doesn't rise to the level to be called by any objective observer secret or top secret.
Yeah, again, we've lost all sort of reasonableness in this nation's classification system. The markings that are being applied, secret, confidential, top secret, however they're being marked, there is no reasonableness anymore. And but the other thing that should be added to what you said is in court, Major Ashton Fine, one of the military prosecutors, asked a witness, I can't remember whom he was cross-examining, but asked a witness if a marking says that the document should be declassified 25 years from now, do you have to abide by that, essentially? Does that mean that that information is something that the United States can keep secret after 25 years if it would choose to do so? And the reality was that in the National Security Agency, you can keep something classified forever. Because if it comes to that date for declassification and you feel like it still has sources and methods that should not be disclosed, you can just add another declassification date to it and mark it. And that way we never get to read it. So what we know to be true is that the NSA has probably thousands upon thousands of documents on what it was doing 50, 60 years ago that we still haven't read, that we do not know, that under classification rules and laws is actually supposed to be public right now.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Now, Kevin, in one of your posts here, you talk about some exchanges in the courtroom about the admissibility of chats, online chats, that Manning had with a person whose name he knew as Zachary Antelak. Tell us about the way the prosecution wants to use chats when it's convenient, but declare them hearsay when it appears to go against their interest.
Right. So this person, Zachary Antelak, testified as Lauren McNamara. That's because Zachary had, I'm assuming, a sex change and decided to become a woman and felt more comfortable being a woman. So that's why that is the case, just so people understand that this isn't a completely mystical thing that was going on in the courtroom.
Okay.
And that the chats between him and Manning were from a period in 2009, and they had discussions about politics and his views on foreign policy, and he was sharing some of his views about the U.S. military and global world issues and what he was thinking about them and what he thought he might like to do as a person after he got out of the military. And so it was important to put this out there because her chats were about whether Manning it went to whether he actually would have been aiding the enemy when he provided information to WikiLeaks. I mean, if you read there, I don't have the exact message that was sent, but there is a point in the chat where he explains why he would give information to a press organization or something to his he explains why he would be interested in reading information in the military, of looking at these different documents, of having an interest in politics to learn and better his understanding so that he could make a better impact on the world. And so it's clear that that is a very idealistic and reasonable explanation and not one that is about
doing harm to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what you're asking me is there was a contest. The prosecutors did not want these chats to be entered into evidence and something that the defense could use for the cross-examination. And it's very remarkable because we've had chat logs entered from Adrian Lamo, the hacker and government informant, and he had chats with Manning. And the prosecutors were saying the chats between Manning and Lauren McNamara were hearsay and possibly not even relevant. Also, I think there were dual objections. Well, the chats with Lamo, how would those not be hearsay if Lamo was able to talk about things that Manning was telling him? And the idea here was that Manning would have to take the stand. He would have to get on the stand to say that this is what he had said to Lauren McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
But that standard had not been applied to Adrian Lamo. Adrian Lamo was able to sit on the stand and say, this is what Bradley Manning said to me.
Yeah, very interesting.
And then also, we've had chat logs entered from this account, Press Association, which the government believes is Julian Assange, but yet we still haven't had evidence that is incontrovertible proof that this account was being used by Julian Assange. So it could have been used by a staffer claiming to be Julian Assange. We don't know. And we don't know what the procedures that people follow within WikiLeaks to collect submissions or to accept submissions from the people who are sources of WikiLeaks. But there wasn't any question about presenting those chats. Those chats were allowed to be part of the proceedings.
Now, Kevin, there was additional testimony presented by the defense, and I want to do something a little different here as a way of bringing into our conversation right now. I want to read to you the final paragraph of an Associated Press story that appeared in my paper here, the San Francisco Chronicle. And I consider it to be one-sided in reflecting the prosecution case and not the testimony of the defense, even though this article was written at the time the defense rested. And it does have a quick summary of the defense, but here's what it says about the prosecution. And again, the article ends, maybe there was more to the story and the Chronicle didn't run at all, but I want you to respond to these statements from the AP story. And you must be in the flight path of Reagan Airport there.
I'm doing a battle of trying to find space where I can do a clear interview today, just because where I'm working, we have active journalism operations ongoing.
Uh-huh.
Also with a housekeeper that was cleaning.
Right.
So
right.
It's been difficult to find a space, but.
All right.
Let me step back out here, and I think we'll be able to complete this without any issue. The office where I have normally done interviews was in use, so I could not be there.
Okay.
But yeah. So go ahead, read me the section, and I'd love to comment.
Prosecutors used 80 witnesses to make their case that Manning used military computers in Iraq to download documents and battlefield video from a classified network, transferred some of the material to his personal computer, and sent it to WikiLeaks. Now, that's pretty straightforward. Then it says, the government's evidence showed that Manning had been trained not to give classified information to unauthorized people. Now, there's much more to the testimony about the lax rules that were in effect in Iraq, and you also noted to me before we started the interview that a witness from Fort Leavenworth talked about how they really haven't changed the procedures, the SOPs in the military, in reaction to this reported grievous damage caused by Bradley Manning's leaks.
Yeah, that's correct. So what we have from this witness at Fort Leavenworth that was put up for everyone, the public, the press, to consume, is that the Center for Army Lessons Learned had actually not adjusted, done anything in order to
respond to the publishing by WikiLeaks. This is from the testimony. I'll just read it. It's quick. Mm-hmm. As of today, I am unaware of any order, request, or suggestion directly to me to study and recommend changes to training and doctrine regarding the handling of classified military information, the supervision of soldiers handling classified military information, or any of the critical Army TTPs, which are tactics, techniques, and procedures, or vulnerabilities based upon the disclosure of information to WikiLeaks. That's pretty clear. That's the military made no critical adjustments. There was no major situation created for the military. They were able to continue doing what the military does. The fact is that while what you read from the AP is true, there are other aspects of the trial that maybe deserve closer consideration.
Well, I just think that after repeating that government claim, they owed their readers and you and me a balanced offering of what the defense said about that, and it's not there. And here's the final sentence from this AP story. Prosecutors also offered evidence that al-Qaeda leaders reveled in WikiLeaks' publication of classified U.S. documents, urging members to study them before devising ways to attack the U.S. Now, there was testimony presented that Osama bin Laden found out about the WikiLeaks disclosures because of the major stink that was raised about it by the U.S. government.
That's correct. So what is the truth here is that you have U.S. government officials who come out and they make a lot of noise about the release of classified information, and they call attention to the disclosures. This is something that we need to universally consider. I believe that there needs to be a lot of time spent reflecting on this reality that has come forward in this trial, that the reason why we're seeing any risks, if those actually exist, to national security after the disclosures of classified information, it's because we have so many people in government who go out and make a lot of noise about the release of information. And then that's when a lot of these groups, these terrorist groups, decide that they might be something they should know about. So that's the importance of that testimony. And it had been misrepresented or presented in a different way by the prosecutors of this thing of, oh, bin Laden just requested WikiLeaks documents. But that didn't actually happen right after the publication. It happened after he heard U.S. government officials talking about the information. So you could say that maybe if the government officials had said nothing about the information, about its danger or anything, maybe bin Laden never would have ever had any interest in that information. And so that means the United States government is aiding the enemy because it is calling attention to information, if we're going to accept their logic, the way that they like to proceed and operate in the world. One of the things that these press organizations haven't done and never do when they're covering these stories is test these claims about national security by anyone who makes them in the case, because all we've had presented is the fact that propagandists from these organizations thought there might be some value to reading the information. Of course, propagandists are going to do what will make the U.S. government upset, what they can do to get a rise out of the U.S. government. There hasn't been anything presented about how this information would have been used for any actual attacks or how it would have been used for any strategies or whatever. Just we have not had that evidence presented, and I can't emphasize that enough, that just hasn't been shared, and nor has it been shared that Bradley Manning was searching for Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Adam Gadan, this propagandist mm-hmm. who's a spokesperson for Al-Qaeda in the right. Arabian Peninsula, the Inspire magazine, that he ever read Inspire magazine. Bradley mm-hmm. Manning never read Inspire magazine. So it's just really ridiculous that this continues to have weight in the courtroom when there is no evidence that shows that Manning had anything to do with any of this.
Now, Kevin, that raises another issue here. Before the trial, I was very concerned that we were going to hear secret evidence from what they called a lightly disguised individual from SEAL Team 6, and that this would have to be presented in secret. So your statement is true as far as public testimony goes. But what was the extent of secret testimony, and did the prosecution actually scale it back from what some of us had expected pre-trial?
The prosecutors did scale back the amount of secret testimony they were going to have. They did stipulations of fact, which means they agreed, prosecutors' defense agreed that this is what the person would say if they were in the courtroom. You had unclassified stipulations published and then classified, so we got to see the part that wasn't secret. And so maybe there was some there. There were only like two or three closed sessions that were ever held by the court to protect classified information, as they said. And so it has been much more reduced. We had heard in January of this year that the prosecutors wanted to close 30% of the trial. The judge objected to that, did not think that that was fair, and she worked out a process to keep it much more open. And that seems to have been the case. There was no SEAL team member that ever took the stand in any disguise. There was no session with that person. Mm-hmm. The SEAL team member stipulated, I think, or actually the SEAL team member was never brought into this. In the defense challenging him, because they did, they actually prevented him from ever testifying. What they did is they obtained factual evidence from whatever he was going to testify to. They got that information somehow else. And that's where we got this information on Wednesday about the true nature of bin Laden's request for WikiLeaks documents from David Coombs. And I must stress, the secrecy in this trial prevents me from being able to actually source that statement from David Coombs to actually say, here is Osama bin Laden's email. He did, in fact, present it this way. But that would also be the case for the earlier story about bin Laden wanting documents. And let's just focus on this for a quick second. The media was very, very okay with saying bin Laden wants WikiLeaks documents. Notice it did not make a lot of headlines that bin Laden only wanted documents because of U.S. government officials. Mm-hmm. That is not receiving equal attention. And it rests on the same basis as the previous set of stories about bin Laden wanting documents. It comes from the same evidence that we have not been able to read because it is classified. So I trust David Coombs that he's not lying in the middle of the courtroom. I believe him when he says that this isn't what bin Laden was actually intending to do. And I'm thinking that this is very significant, that people need to really consider what it means that this is actually another layer to the farce that is Bradley Manning's trial.
And Kevin, the coverage of the defense resting made a big deal that Bradley Manning did notify the court officially that he would not be testifying. I'm not at all surprised by that. And the insertion of his statement in the pretrial proceedings appeared to be the best way to get his point of view presented to the court without exposing him to a blistering cross-examination. That said, I'm still a little surprised that Coombs only called 9 of a potential list of 46 witnesses. And that is the posture that the defense takes in a trial where they feel the prosecution has not proven to, beyond a reasonable doubt, the charges that have been presented. But here we have a much different situation where Manning has already pled to 10 minor charges. We're quibbling over really the penalty for that guilty plea and whatever he is found guilty of the 21 counts that remained at the outset of this trial. Now, Coombs has moved to dismiss somewhere between 4 and 7 of those counts. Why don't you pick up there on what the next steps are in the proceedings and how you, if you have any view about defense strategy?
So the next steps in the trial are that we're going to have argument over these motions. They're for motions of a finding of not guilty, which means that there is an evidence for these charges. So the defense takes the move after the prosecution presents their case, and they say to the judge, we don't see evidence that he aided the enemy. We don't see evidence that he exceeded access on his computer that he was authorized. We don't see that he stole information. There's no information. There's no evidence presented. So we would like to have argument over this, and we would like you to find before you issue your conviction of him that he is not guilty because there is no evidence. And that will be an argument we hear on Monday. The government wants to do a rebuttal, but there has to be argument over the scope of that rebuttal. And I don't know a whole lot about this process-wise, but apparently in the federal courts, if you are in the case, the government doesn't usually get to put on a rebuttal case to the defense. That's just not something that happens. But apparently in the military, you're allowed to do that as prosecutors. And then we could get closing arguments next week. But I think that the reason why it was so short is what you're saying is you can interpret it that maybe there isn't a lot of evidence to rebut, and you can't, you know, you argue against what you don't see there. If it doesn't exist, you can't argue against it.
Mm-hmm.
So also the other fact is I've heard people who know that back in the pretrial phase, the defense was boxed in and prevented from discussing harm or damage from the leaks in their trial, in the actual defense case. That was a argument that was heard. The prosecutor successfully convinced the judge that it was not relevant whether damage or harm had been caused. So that may have shortened the case considerably. Or it could be that the most significant part of the case is coming in the sentencing phase, that no matter what, Manning's going to be convicted. But what's really important is a lot of the testimony that they're saving is going to come out in the sentencing phase about this information. And they're going to go over it again to show that he really should not be in jail for any lengthy period of time. Just maybe the time that goes to what he pled guilty to doing already, but not these other charges that the prosecutors have pursued against him.
Right. Well, it's going to be very interesting, and it has certainly proceeded much faster than we expected. But, you know, from all observations I have at this distance, Kevin, David Coombs has done a pretty good job of managing a difficult case in a very toxic climate. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how the final arguments play out and then moving into the sentencing phase. Is there anything from these recent events that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to mention here as we wrap up?
Well, let me just give a shout to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, who has been publishing transcripts. They also gave me some money, grant, so that I could continue to do coverage throughout this entire summer of the Bradley Manning trial. And I want people to go read the testimony on Wednesday from Professor Yochai Bankler of Harvard to see what was entered into the court record. He was qualified as an expert to talk about WikiLeaks, and he described what is a legitimate journalistic organization. This isn't the organization committed to exfiltrating secrets and publishing them on the web so that enemies of the United States can launch all sorts of attacks against the United States, as the prosecutors have presented. This is a organization that was a respectable whistleblowing website, and that's how it was viewed up until the point that U.S. government officials started reacting to Manning's releases. And it only changed when the U.S. government started talking about WikiLeaks negatively, because it was upset that they were now a target of the media organization. And I just think people should really read that because it's significant. What he was testifying about could make the difference in whether Manning is convicted of aiding the enemy.
Kevin Gostola, I really appreciate the hard work you've been doing live blogging for FireDogLake.com at the Manning Court Martial. And we'll recap next week's proceedings with you again on Friday. And I'll look forward to talking with you then.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening all the way to the very end of this important podcast. We'll update the Bradley Manning case again next week here at PeterBCollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.